You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS.
And Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Thursday, April 18th, 2013. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, Jonathan Cohn on his piece in the New Republic on the hell that is U.S. child care. Also on the program today, watered down gun safety bill, expansion of background checks, fails to get a vote in the U.S. Senate. Also on the program today, the New York Post, once again, fingers two people as suspects in the Boston Marathon bombing who are not suspects, puts their picture on the front page of the newspaper. This following the day where CNN misreported that a suspect had been arrested, that the suspect had brown skin, that they had to be cautious and to speculate simultaneously. Also on the program today, Republicans continue to be insane. Mark Sanford loses support of the National Republican Party because he's clearly suffering from some pathology. It could be just such intense narcissism that even the National Republican Party can't deal with it. More on the budget proposal. A lot of things on the docket today, folks. Let's start with this before we get to Jonathan Cohn. Yesterday in the Senate, a watered-down version of expansion of background checks, which has been something that the NRA has supported in the past, that six of the Republican senators who voted against yesterday had voted for in the past, did not get enough votes to break a filibuster for a vote. The Democrats who voted against it, Mark Begich, Max Baucus, Heidi Heitkamp, Mark Pryor, and Harry Reid for procedural reasons. Republicans that voted for essentially closing debate and allowing a vote to go forward, Toomey, who had co-sponsored the bill with Manchin, Kirk from Illinois, Collins from Maine, and John McCain. Who knows, John McCain may have some personal grudge against somebody that led him to vote in the proper way in this instance. The final tally was 54 to 46. Never got the vote. President Obama, following the vote, had this to say.
So while this compromise didn't contain everything I wanted or everything that these families wanted, it did represent progress. It represented moderation and common sense. That's why 90% of the American people supported it. But instead of supporting this compromise, the gun lobby and its allies willfully lied about the bill. They claimed that it would create some sort of Big Brother gun registry, even though the bill did the opposite. This legislation, in fact, outlawed any registry. Plain and simple, right there in the text. But that didn't matter. And unfortunately, this pattern of spreading untruths about this legislation served a purpose, because those lies upset an intense minority of gun owners. And that, in turn, intimidated a lot of senators.
So that's it for any type of sensible or any type of gun safety legislation. It dies in the Senate for a number of reasons. You had people who are going to be up for re-election in red states in 2014. You had Harry Reid, who refused to reform the way that the Senate does its business in terms of a filibuster. You had perhaps a failure for President Obama to be able to convince and bring along some of those Democrats and essentially basically exercise any type of real strength in this situation. So that's that. And I think, you know, part of it, frankly, at the end of the day, is that none of these senators who voted against giving the opportunity for this bill a chance to vote feel that they are going to be electorally jeopardized because of it. That's the bottom line. All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, Jonathan Cohn from New Republic.
To let me know, should I stay or should I go? If you say that you are mine, I'll be here till the end of time. So you got to let me know, should I stay or should I go? It's always tease, tease, tease. You're happy when I'm on my knees. One day is fine, the next is black. So if you want me off your back, well, come on and let me know. Should I stay or should I go? Should I stay or should I go now? Should I stay or should I go now?
We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program from the New Republic, Jonathan Cohn. Jonathan, thanks for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me on the show.
The piece in the New Republic, I think this current issue of the New Republic is entitled "The Hell of American Daycare." It's a it's a great piece. It's a pretty emotional read. In addition to being really informational about an issue that for some reason it seems to get has had traditionally very little attention paid to it in this country. But let's first just start with the issue in and of itself. You have found, and I know you've done stories in the past about the importance of children's development in the first couple of years of their life. Talk about that a little bit, because it really is the predicate to why our failure to provide daycare in this country is so problematic.
Sure. You know, I think, you know, it doesn't take a genius to recognize that the first, you know, early in life, first few experiences are going to be important. But in the last 20 or 30 years, scientists, and I use that term broadly to include, you know, neuro researchers, psychologists, biologists, doctors, have really been able to pinpoint the way that what you experience very early in life, particularly your first 2 years, your first 3 years, that has an incredibly powerful effect on how you will act and behave later in life, down to the level of, you know, where experiences, what you experience in those first few years actually changes the architecture of your brain. And so we know for a fact that, you know, if you grow up in a sort of nurturing environment, in a supportive environment, and you have lots of good, positive give and take interactions with an adult as a baby, you're going to kind of, your brain's going to develop in a way that you'll be, you know, you're much more likely to not just to be smarter, but to have kind of, you know, the ability to focus, you know, the sort of what a lot of people call the soft skills that allow you to succeed in life, whether it's in business or school or whatever, any activity. The flip side, if you're not in that kind of environment, you're not getting that kind of stimulation, you're not getting the interaction, or worse still, you're actually experiencing some kind of negligence or abuse, you're not going to develop those skills. And these are the kids that are much more likely to grow up when they get older. They end up in trouble in school. They end up in trouble with the law. And, you know, it's horrible for these kids. It's bad for society, obviously. And even if you just want to be, think about the numbers here, the dollars, it's bad for us because, you know, it's a lot cheaper spend that money up front on making sure these kids are in a good preschool and a good environment than it is to spend the money 20 years later, you know, on special education and, you know, on juvenile detention and unemployment and extra, you know, health care, because a lot of these people end up with health problems, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
And a lot of this really has to do in many respects. I mean, we say, you know, sort of a nurturing environment. We're also talking about this is something that really impacts, I mean, it impacts low-income people sort of in two ways. One, that if you're in maybe middle or upper middle income, you have a lot more opportunity, obviously, because you have cash to send your kids to daycare. If you are lower income, you don't have as much opportunity to do so. And we also know, I mean, this statistic I found some time back, I think it was when I was doing Up for a couple of days. Children of low-income families enter into kindergarten with a listening vocabulary of 17,000 fewer words than that of a child of middle income. I mean, so the deficit that kids, lower-income kids, deal with starts right out of the gate, and it's impossible to make that up.
Yeah, it's a real double whammy for just as you put it. I mean, you know, if you're in a low income family, strike one is you can't find, you know, it's a lot harder to find a good daycare or preschool for your child because you can't afford it. And then the second whammy is that now that you've been penalized because you can't get, you know, that's the penalty. As a result, when your kids grow up, you know, now they're now worse off. I mean, just and it happens right away. Like you said, they enter kindergarten and they haven't heard as many spoken words. And you know, everything we know about how kids develop language skills, how to read, how to write, how to speak, you know, that's all about the give and take with adults about speaking and hearing. And you know, it's tragic.
And okay, so what is the state of daycare in this country? I mean, how many people get it, and to the extent that they do get it, how do they get it? And your story focuses around the sort of the one aspect also of the story is just how loosely regulated daycare is in different states. I guess it depends on where you are. There's no national standard here.
That's right. And you know, and the preface to this, I should say, is that it was shocking to me that how little information we have about daycare in the United States, even at the level of how many kids are in daycare. I mean, the numbers I use are the census numbers, but if you talk to the people at the Census Bureau, they'll tell you they're not the most perfect numbers because they're like based on questions in a survey and it's the categories are a little blurry. So it's not, even just to make a blank statement, this is how many children are in daycare, is actually a very difficult statement to make. But you know, roughly speaking, there's several million children every day who are, and it's somewhere between, you know, a third and a half or maybe more, who are in the care of someone other than their parents. And again, it depends on, you know, some of them are just some days a week, some are every day a week, but it's a very large number of children. And it's, and you know, and it's a reflection of the fact that unlike 100, 150 years ago, the majority of kids now have their mother's work. Women are now in the workforce. I think that's a, you know, and that's a good thing. This was a sign of our progress. But, you know, we haven't yet sort of come to terms with the fact that, okay, well, if we're not, you know, if kids aren't all going to, you know, majority of them aren't going to be taken care of at home by a relative, well, who is going to take care of them? And that's where we get into the question, well, what kind of daycare is out there? And the best information we have is it's not very good overall. There are some great daycares out there, some small percentage, but the majority of them are mediocre at best, and then there's a small minority that are really horrible. And they're horrible both in the sense they don't provide the kids with what they need, and they're horrible in the sense they can actually be hazardous. Kids are in unsafe environments. And this is, again, you know, this is not something we would tolerate in our public schools. Even though, you know, lots of public schools have problems, we would not tolerate this level of quality in our public schools. But for some reason, we do frequently when it comes to daycare.
Well, this is really one of the big takeaways of your piece is that, and it sort of bleeds through in these different fashions, that there is very little data on it, that there has been, I guess over the years, a couple of you cite a couple of times where there's been attempts to increase daycare, but that it's not really a national issue. Now in the 1960s, we started Head Start, I guess it was, and you also mentioned two programs, Georgia and Oklahoma, which were, I think, the Georgia was cited by President Obama, I believe it was in the State of the Union, when he spoke about universal pre-K. But just tell us about the plans that are in existence now and their pluses and minuses.
Sure. So we do have Head Start, which started in the 60s. And, you know, Head Start was, it's important to think of, you know, when we say daycare, what are we talking about? Are we talking about a program that's basically for working parents so that their kids are in a safe, nurturing place where they get some, you know, good stimulation or whatever? Head Start is not that exactly. Head Start is something different. Head Start is basically a very targeted effort to help very low-income kids from backgrounds that put them at risk of failure later in life and give those kids the skills they need. Now, there's a whole separate controversy, and we don't need to get into right now, about whether Head Start really lives up to that potential or not as a program. But, you know, apart from that, you know, Head Start exists. It is, you know, in general, you know, in terms of fulfilling the function of a daycare, it's pretty good. The problem is it's pretty small. I mean, it vastly serves a fraction of the kids who would be eligible to be in that program. We do, the government does provide money to assist some people paying for daycare. There's something called the child, it's a mouthful, but it's basically the Child Development and Block Grant. And that is basically money that goes to the states. So the states can provide vouchers to people who need help paying for daycare. And that's a very good program. The problem is the vouchers aren't that big and there aren't that many of them. So most states you have waiting lists for assistance with daycare. There are tax credits. The tax code, you know, if you have kids, you can take some money off your taxes, and there's an extra one. You know, again, that sort of, so a lot of these are targeted more to low-income families. But the bottom line is that we provide some assistance. We provide some care directly through Head Start, but it's not nearly enough to meet the need that we have, which is much greater than the need that existed when these programs came into existence.
Now, what's happening in these sort of pilot programs in Georgia and Oklahoma?
So in Georgia and Oklahoma, on their own, both decided to start what they call universal pre-K programs, basically saying, you know, they basically programs or preschool programs where basically the government says, we will help you pay for preschool if you can't afford it on your own. And these programs seem to be doing pretty well. They're popular. Researchers have been looking at the effects of them and have found that kids who go through them end up better off. They cost a fair amount of money. In a lot of other states, you know, we're waiting, you know, most states don't do that. Now,
what do you make of the fact that it's these two states that are doing it? I mean, it seems to me they wouldn't be the first states that I guess would be doing it. You know what I mean?
No, that's right. That's right. I mean, you mean that because they're more conservative states and more
they're
red
more conservative.
States?
It's a you know, it's a big government program, I guess. But what are we to make of the fact that these states are doing it and that it is popular, both in terms of the opportunity it presents for a national type of program, or you know, however it's administered, and the fact that these are programs that are taking place in red states.
Yeah, no, I actually think this is one of the things that make me most optimistic about the future. You know, the fact that you did have Georgia do this, you did have Oklahoma do this. You know, the idea of doing something to help kids, young kids, I mean, I do believe that's something that has a lot of appeal, regardless of ideology, regardless of political orientation. And I think that the evidence that we have on these programs is strong enough that you can be a conservative and you can look at these and say, you know what, I may not like government, I may not like to spend money, but this is one of those investments that just makes sense to me. I can see the numbers add up. I want to do something good for kids. And that's why these programs have been able to come, you know, survive, you know, to pass and to survive and to thrive. In states that, you know, in conservative states that are very, you know, not the places you would expect. And I think going forward, that's just there is an openness. There's at least an open mind about this and maybe a constituency for doing something meaningful on early childhood that gets out of the sort of just, it's not going to be just liberals. It's not going to just be the New England states. There is a broad constituency for there. You know, maybe something can happen over time. It does take money to do this right. If you think about what the problems are with childcare and you look at what it takes to fix the problems, at the end of the day, you're always having to find some money. And obviously in this political environment, money is hard to come by. And in general, conservatives are less excited about it. But it can be done. And I think, you know, there's hope that I think over the next few years, maybe something will get done.
I'm still sort of baffled by this because on one hand, right, I mean, you mentioned in the piece that the only time that we had any real sort of a national style program for this daycare happened during World War II, where obviously women had to leave the home, go in and work in factories for the war effort as many men were off fighting. And it was an easy sell insofar as it was a patriotic duty. Right. I mean, we have to take care of the kids because the women have to go work. And then after the war, the entire program is basically scrapped because now it's time for the women to get back into the home. Obviously, you mentioned that things have changed dramatically in the last 30, I guess now 40 years in terms of women in the workforce. But there just seems to be a tremendous vacuum in talking about this, and it just seems so important. And then I just can't reconcile how it is that Georgia happens to be the state that addresses it.
Yeah, no, I mean, look, the lack of attention to this on a national issue, it shocks me. And, you know, one sign of it is, like I said, how little information we even have on this. I mean, if we cared about this, surely we'd be studying it a little more closely. You know, another sign, and this is very anecdotal, but I think it's kind of telling. I went back for my research. I looked at the archives of Time Magazine and Newsweek, right, the two big newsweeklies. And I said, how often did they put daycare on the cover of the magazine, right? Because that's kind of a good leading indicator of what the country thinks about it. It's on the cover of Time, right?
Yes, or at least a lagging indicator.
Yeah, a lagging indicator, right? You know, and whatever. This is not scientific. It's possible right. I missed right. something. I didn't do the right search term. But as best I can tell, going back to the early 1970s, there was one cover for something that, you know, affects a huge number of kids, a large proportion of Americans. And, you know, even though a lot of my article, what we've been talking about the last few minutes, is about more lower-income parents, I think middle-income parents, they go through very similar things. I mean, they know this struggle, right? You know, I got to find daycare for my kids. I can't find something that I trust. What I can find that I trust is way more than I thought it was going to be. So, I mean, you would think this would be a big issue, and it really hasn't been. There are various theories why. I mean, I think one reason it hasn't gotten more attention at the national level in Congress is the sort of obvious one, which is, look, I mean, you know, raising kids is something that we you know, they got left, you know, for women's day. It was a women's issue. It was a women's job. And, you know, men, whatever, they went off to work and dumped the kids with their wife. And, you know, look at Congress. It was mostly men. Now, it's still mostly men, but it's not nearly as imbalanced as it used to be. And we're getting more women in Congress. We're also getting men in Congress who are younger. And I think in general there's a generational shift here where men, younger men, men my age, you know, where I have two kids, you know, I'm used to sort of treating, you know, parenting as an equal responsibility. So you have parents who, you know, the men who are coming to Congress now, they have working spouses. They're more likely to have, you know, to be treating sort of, you know, parenting as something that's on their brain as well. So I think that's one reason why this will maybe now start to shift on a national level. You know, I don't know enough of the backstory in Georgia and Oklahoma to tell you why it happened to percolate there. You know, state legislatures are always kind of quirky. But I do feel
like Oklahoma one
is a
pretty quirky state legislature. I don't know if you see one.
Yes, it is. And, you know, and the story I heard there was, I think, you know, that was one of those where something got passed and people didn't realize what they were voting for. I mean, it was a weird story. But whatever. I mean, whatever the circumstances of the enactment, it's a popular program and
right.
People like it and they take pride in it now. And which I think is a testimony to the fact that this is something, you know, that has bipartisan feel. You know, I remember when I was working on the stories about how the brain develops, and I talked to some of the experts, and they told me, you know, we used to go into, you know, so we go into red states all the time, and people, you know, this is not ideological, that conservatives, liberals, you know, they get that, and they care about it, and, you know, and particularly, you know, among religious groups, you know, across the political spectrum, people feel like, you know, helping children is something that has an innately broad appeal, as it should.
It's interesting, too, because I know that you've been working on this piece for some time, I imagine quite a bit of time prior to President Obama raising this proposal in the State of the Union. And I wonder if part of that equation is also a function of the rise of single women at least a perceived electoral force. And if that isn't, you know, that we're going to see more of this because that is a constituency that is now perceived as one that can really affect the outcome of an election.
You know, that's interesting. And I don't know enough about the politics of this to say anything definitively. I mean, it's, you know, there are issues, you know, it's not enough to say, people like this issue, they care, you know, they agree. I mean, in general, I think if you say, do she have good daycare available for kids, you know, you'll get lots of people who say they support it, you know, but then the question is, you know, well, what are they willing to sacrifice in terms of spending elsewhere or taxes or other priorities, and do they care about it when they go to the voting booth? I mean, who knows? I mean, there's a whole separate discussion about that. But, you know, I do feel like there's a sense, you know, I mean, this issue has come up before in Congress. There was a bill, you know, in the 1970s that President Nixon vetoed. In the 80s, there were some attempts to sort of organize around daycare, and it kind of ended up becoming the energies ended up being expended on family and medical leave, which they worked on, you know, in the late 80s, early 90s, and it was teed up for when Bill Clinton became president and he signed that into law. I do feel like there's a sense that the constituency for this is growing and that this is an issue that politicians, you know, it's a chance for them to sort of do something that will tangibly help people who vote. So, I think the long term picture on this is that politically people see this as a winner. I would think many Republicans as well as Democrats, but you know, the long term can be, well, you know, it can be pretty long.
And I wonder how much the idea, I mean, you know, it's almost when you really start to think about it, or at least when I really start to think about it, it's surprising to me that there isn't already some type of like tax expenditure, you know, some type of tax credit for this. I mean, and then I guess in second thought, it's also sort of such a tax credit would be so really have the biggest impact in terms of middle class families, I would imagine, right? Because if you're
there are tax credits, they're just not very big right now. And I mean, you know, if you look abroad at all at sort of the countries that do this, they typically, you know, they provide, you know, subsidies for daycare, but a lot of times it's done as a tax break. You know, in part to say to families, if you would rather have a parent stay home, be it a mom, dad, whatever, you know, rather than send your kid into a daycare, or you want to do it sort of part-time, you know, we'll give you some support for that as well. You know, we don't want to be penalizing, you know, that choice. So, you know, that's usually what the other countries do. And, you know, we do have some tax breaks, just they're just not nearly big enough for the reason.
Lastly, what if you were to be able to design something, and what because I have little doubt that in terms of the developed countries, we are lagging behind in providing this type of support for folks. What system would you base it on? I mean, where, when you look at other sort of child care programs that exist, what would you base it on? What would it look like?
So, I mean, it's easier to sort of to say, I mean, there's two questions. Sort of, what do you want the actual care to look like for the kids? And then how does the government get you there, right? So the first part, I mean, I think we know what the qualities look like. It actually would probably look a lot, it would look something like what they do in France, although, you know, every culture is different and there will be cultural differences between France and the United States. It would actually, a pretty good example here in the United States is what we have for the U.S. military. Care on U.S. military bases is actually considered to be quite good for the most part, you know, and that in the sense that the people, when they're doing it right, and there have been some lapses recently, but, you know, when they do it right, they're pretty, you know, they hire people with experience, they pay them a little better, they have reasonably strong regulations about the number of adults per child, you know, the safety regulations are pretty strong, and then they inspect them four times a year, which is much higher than most states do. And so it would probably look something like that. And then, you know, how the government would sort of get you there, I don't know. You know, this doesn't – I think there's a lot of different – that's a more open question, but presumably it involves some kind of subsidies combined with some kind of tax credits. Again, you would want to make it – so the goal here is that anybody can afford this regardless of their income. And, you know, again, if people want to have more time at home and less time with a kid in daycare, you don't want to penalize that choice. So you got to figure out how to do that, and that's a whole other conversation. But that's, I think, where you want to get to in the end of the day, something that looks like what the military has or maybe has some things in common with what they do now in France and some other European countries.
Once again, the military proves just how well socialism works.
right.
If we can only get them to spread that to the rest of the country, we would be far better off. Well, Jonathan, I appreciate you taking the time to talk to us today. We have not done justice to the emotional component of your story, and I can't recommend to people enough that you go and check it out in the New Republic, The Hell of American Daycare. Jonathan Cohn, author of Sick, The Untold Story of America's Healthcare Crisis and the People Who Pay the Price, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on the show and talking about this.
Okay. All right, folks. We're going to head into the other half, the better half of the program. There we will go over some of the highlights of the day yesterday, where CNN fingered some brown-skinned people as involved in the terrorist attack. Of course, fortunately for us at the time, they were arrested, and then they had to walk that back in the sort of stunning state of American journalism in this country. Also, we will talk about the New York Post. I don't know if you could say that they fingered some brown-skinned people, but just it seems like they just picked out two random people that they had a photograph of.
They were like, you know what, we should relax after the whole Saudi guy thing, so let's just put a couple of high school kids up there.
Yes, exactly.
Take that for a spin.
Eventually, I think if the Post continues, eventually they may actually finger the right person. But there's going to be, literally, they may have to go through thousands of...
They're just doing process of elimination.
Right, yeah, exactly. We're just going to, one by one, put pictures of everyone who were at the Boston Marathon on the cover of our paper. And eventually, when not enough people say, hey, wait a second, those aren't the people, we'll know that is the people who perpetrated it. That seems to be the strategy.
They'll post on the front page the actual guy the day after the FBI actually says that's the guy, and then they'll say, oh, look, we got him.
Right. Who knows? We will talk about that. And also, we've got video. You can hear some audio, and I will walk people through, but Mark Sanford has had such an implosion in the past 2 days. it is fascinating the level of narcissism involved with this guy. And, you know, look, I'm not judging this guy's, you know, sort of fidelity to his family, but the cruelty that he exhibits towards his young son, I think, is what really sort of gets me. We will talk about that. And
the clip will be included in our YouTube video. So if you're not a regular YouTube watcher of ours at youtube.com/Sam Cedar, you can go there after and you can watch the whole story with the clip inserted as well.
I see. All right.
Trying to do something.
No, I know what you're trying to do. Here. I get where you're going with this. And also, we mentioned this with Jonathan Cohn. The Oklahoma State Senate is, they are unique, I think, in some respects. We will talk about the ethnic slurs that were used, but not just that, like, in a tangential story, not even remotely involved. It was also sort of, they're crazy there. So all that and more, folks. It is, we will also touch on guns. Obviously, tomorrow we'll have Cliff Schechter on, and no pun intended, I want to keep my powder dry for Cliff, who is bound to have plenty to say on guns. Tomorrow we will talk about that as well, and we may briefly touch on, I would imagine most people are aware of, the horrible explosion that took place in West Texas, not West Texas in terms of the region of the state. 15 dead now, over 100 injured. What seems to have been a transportation hub, I don't know if it was the plant or the stuff was stored in a warehouse at the plant of fertilizer, and had something to do with one of the trains that was to transport this, leaked some type of gas, a fire was started, and a massive explosion that, like I said, took the lives of 15 people and injured over 100. Just really horrible. But you can find more on that maybe. I mean, I don't know if there's any value in us playing the video of it. You can hear it. It's really sort of terrifying. We're going to take a break. We'll head into the better half of the program. You can call this program at 646-257-3920. I will take your phone calls on just about any topic that you are interested in talking about. 646-257-3920. You can IM me at Majority FM. Folks, it's your memberships that make this show possible. I say this every day. It is the case. It is your memberships which will make this show even better as we go forward. Won't have to do as much bartering with my producers, but that's a different story. The contractual relationship I have, of course, with Matt and Michael. You can become a member at majority.fm, become a member, and support the show by buying your Amazon junk through our Amazon link at majority.fm/support-the-show. You'll find the link. Click it, bookmark it, buy all your stuff through there. You won't notice a difference. We will. We get a little kickback on that. And justcoffee.coop, fair trade, coffee, tea, or chocolate. We'll be back in a moment.
Apple pen.